Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, we're going to take a look at the ICO bubble. That's the initial coin offering bubble. We'll be hearing some excerpts from a chat I had with CoinJar CEO Asher Tan. And then Adam and I are going to talk about what the hell is happening with all this crypto madness, my God. And you know what? I actually have for you, for all you listeners, I actually have found a clip, an audio clip, that perfectly explains what an ICO token is.
Now, would you like to buy some itchy and scratchy money?
What's that?
Well, it's money that's made just for the park. It works just like regular money, but it's, fun.
Do it, Dad.
Well, okay, if it's fun. Let's see, I'll take $1,100 worth.
Yeah, good luck spending your itchy and scratchy money, pal. But yeah, we'll take a look at the ICO phenomenon. It's a crazy, crazy old world, let me tell you. This week's show is brought to you by NetSparker. NetSparker makes an automated web application security testing tool. You can dial up the level of automation you want, and they have a few nice tricks in their suite too, like auto proof of concept exploitation of some bug classes, so you can actually prove people need to fix stuff while you drink coffee. That's a nice feature. And in this week's sponsor interview, we're chatting with Faru Mavituna, who is the founder and CEO of NetSparker, about automated testing at scale. It's a sponsor interview, but it's also a pretty generic chat about how you tackle that problem. Basically, he says that when you're doing this stuff at scale, you can really start with the bad, dumb, easy stuff. Because if you're in an enterprise of any sort of scale, your automated testing is going to spit out a horror show list. Like you'll have plenty to do without dialing up too sophisticated testing on non-core apps. But obviously there's more to it than that. And Faru is along later to discuss it with me. But before all of that, let's get into the week's news now with Adam Boileau, who is back from his company retreat. And Adam, Brian Krebs has done some absolutely spectacular work in linking together the various nicks and handles of one Marcus Hutchins, otherwise known as Malware Tech.
Yeah, Krebs has been Krebsing, as he is prone to do, and has apparently spent the last 3 weeks of his life rummaging through the backstory of Marcus Hutchins and all of the various threads that head off back into fairly black hat territory, it does appear. So yeah, not. I don't know that we're super surprised. I mean, I know when we talked about this a few weeks back when he first got arrested after DEF CON, you know, that... You know, they were alleging that he had been involved in banking trojans and stuff. And, you know, certainly there are a lot of people in this industry, you know, who have come from a background of being, either a teenage dumbass, you know, or involved in actually, you know, kind of genuinely criminal shit. But, yeah, Krebs has dug through a lot of digging in the hack forums archives, tying together domain registrations and email addresses and a few people, you know, human sources as well. And, yeah, the story does appear to go that – you know, some of his earlier incantations of nicknames were selling, you know, keyloggers and antivirus scanning services and other, you know, things on the dark markets. And then onwards into, you know, actual more kind of Trojan-y sort of things. So, yeah. Interesting plot twist, eh?
Yeah, well, I mean, I did mention when we spoke about it some time ago that I had caught some rumors and it looks like, you know, instead of just flapping his gums like I did, Krebs actually went and did the work. And he presents a pretty compelling case that Hutchins was up to no good. Now, what's really funny is watching people on Twitter going straight away, switching from, he didn't do it, this is ridiculous, he's a hero, he stopped WannaCry. They've switched from that to, so what, everyone's got a past. What does that matter? It's crazy seeing that happen, don't you think?
Yeah, now that is a bit of a very rapid shift rather than going, well, you know, actually some of this stuff is fairly properly shady and there's plenty of us who didn't indulge in selling malware on the internet when we were 15, so, you know.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I don't think this guy deserves serious prison time, but it's difficult to criticize the FBI for charging him with computer crime offenses when it looks like he was involved in computer crime, because that's kind of the FBI's job. But this does remind me, I mean, the charges that he's facing, if it was someone who was a total clean skin otherwise, right, you would think, hey, come on, you know, maybe just let that slide if they made one error in judgment. But this reminds me of a situation we had here in Australia. Everybody's heard of the Distribute IT hack. This is when someone broke into a company called Distribute IT. They basically RMRF'd the whole lot and took the company out of business. That attacker went to prison, but not for that hack. His next victim sort of caught him in the middle of what he was doing. They called the AFP. They realized who it was, and they sort of worked really hard just logging everything in sort of a pseudo sting until they could get him. So I guess what I'm suggesting is that if you can't catch people for everything they've done, like, anything will do. I mean, Al Capone went to prison for tax evasion, for God's sakes. Not that I'm comparing Marcus Hutchins to Al Capone, but you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it does kind of make sense. They have to start somewhere. And especially if they were working on he's going to be in the country for a week, a couple of weeks. We've got to come up with something quickly. You go with what you can hang on them right now, and you've got some time to go build the rest of your case. And we may see, more charges come down as it proceeds.
I reckon they'll be happy just with this alone. That's my gut feeling. And, I don't think he should do time personally, because he has clearly turned it around. But that said, like, people saying that the FBI are being jerks, I got to say, I kind of disagree. They're just doing their job. Now, Adam, in a story that I'm sure is near and dear to your heart, some goings on with Solaris.
Yeah, it looks like Oracle has laid off a whole bunch of people that worked on the Solaris and Spark hardware teams. The general feeling seems to be that this is, the end of the line for really the corpse of Sun Microsystems, as was acquired by Oracle and ruined some years ago, with not very many things left, actually. Oracle, for its part, is saying that there won't be a future, new major release of Solaris. They're going to keep doing incremental updates, and they're kind of positioning this as, new and agile and hip. But basically, they're putting it on life support until the support contracts run out in, 2030, whenever it is that the current Solaris 11 release is slated to run out. But yeah, a sad, sad day for all of us, all of those of us that grew up looking up to those big commercial Unix boxes that, when we had, rubbish, early Linux on 486s or whatever in our bedrooms, the Spark hardware and the Solaris was a real Unix with capital U. Kind of a pity to see, the last of Sun's empire crumbling into the dust.
And it looks like Oracle's kind of pushing, Cloud Spark.
Yeah, that was one of the other bits of the announcement, is they're saying, well, if you've got stuff that, you compiled for Spark 15 years ago and still needs to run on it, and you lost the source code because you're dicks, well, we're going to run some Cloud Spark, or they're going to run Spark on x86, like run some kind of emulator, and let you pay lots and lots of money to run your enterprise Spark apps in the cloud. But yeah, it's just a big old knife in the corpse of Sun.
Nice. Turning our attention to Africa now, and Kenya's Supreme Court has declared the presidential election null and ordered for the election to be conducted again. Now, the reason we're speaking about this in Risky Business is because some weeks ago there was a lot of reporting around this idea that the Kenyan election may have been hacked. So this was the opposition candidate, Raila Odinga, alleging that the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission had been owned, and their algorithm set to ensure an 11% difference in favor of the incumbent president. Now, where this gets interesting is the evidence they've presented for this is really not evidence. Now, the Supreme Court might have ruled on other aspects to this that don't involve, charges of hacking. But I find this really interesting that just the allegation of hacking, spreading like wildfire over there, has sort of created a climate where people kind of expected this election to be done over. I mean, this is hacking fears, not real hacking, just hacking fears that have contributed to the scuttling of an election.
So yeah, the backstory to this is really interesting. So back about 2007, there was an election that went, kind of horribly wrong in Kenya, and there was a bunch of violence. People got killed, and they ended up setting up a commission to kind of investigate the functioning of their democracy and what they could do to kind of make the elections an actual viable thing. That resulted in a bunch of proposals that had, a much more technological approach to running elections, so biometric voter identification and electronic collection and reporting and real-time streaming of results. And that system was eventually built and ran the elections in 2013. And of course, as you would expect for, a technological system, went horribly wrong. All sorts of things crashed. The databases, were denial of service just under the sheer load. The biometrics didn't work very well. Everything was kind of a mess. And that led to some challenges to the legitimacy of that election that weren't in the end upheld. And a lot of people were very kind of skeptical about the results of this, new, more technological approach. So this one rolls around. And the results were very close. And it did seem that the infrastructure largely worked in this election. But yeah, the results have been challenged and the court has now kind of thrown out the result. They're going to have another election. But yeah, these allegations of hacking, like given the backstory of the last one going wrong for, you know, availability reasons, you can see why, you know, integrity of the vote would be a thing people would be concerned about. But the opposition guy who has lost and has, you know, challenged the legality of it, his party put forward some evidence, like actual technical evidence of the electoral commission-y, you know, central systems being hacked. And the evidence,
yeah, they were just like doctored log files that weren't at all convincing.
Yeah, so it was like screenshots of a Microsoft SQL Server log file, like showing essentially normal operation, you know, someone trying to log in, getting their password wrong, and, you know, a few kind of stored procedures running. And they've kind of conflated those, and including like some timestamps that it makes sense and clearly like clear doctoring of some of the lines in the log, and draw conclusions that, you know, they were hacked and all sorts of things that really, you know, just aren't at all supported by what so far is the published evidence. But yeah, like, as you say, even the sort of the boogeyman of hacking, fear of it.
That's what I'm getting at. Now, look, it doesn't help that shortly before the election, Chris Misando, who was the head of the Electoral Commission's IT programs, was tortured and murdered. But the thing is, this is a bell you can ring now. If you don't like the way an election's going, you can cry hacking. And people will listen to it. Now, I'm not saying that the Supreme Court in this case, I'm not an expert in Kenyan politics. There may have been a lot going on over there that led to the Supreme Court making its decision. But the point is, this has been an active story over there for quite a while. And that's, we're going to see more of this.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that, you know, the very high profile interference with the American elections has really put this on everybody's mind. And as you say, it's a thing that, you know, in all of the elections since, you know, since Trump, you know, we have seen hacking and the specter of hacking as a thing that is occupying, you know, column inches. I mean, we've had the elections in the UK. We've got an election coming up in New Zealand very soon. And I'm sure people will be talking about hacking the results of those things as well. So, yeah, it's a thing that people will, of course, point to. And you know, the idea that, you know, elections in Africa are not always run, you know, entirely smoothly and without interference, I don't think is a contentious position based on the history. But yeah, like whether or not it's actually hacking, we, you know, it's not that it's not possible. That's the thing, right? We, you know, yeah, as listeners to this podcast know, right, hacking is a thing you can do. But, you know, whether or not that's what's going on in Kenya, we just, you know, it's not the SQL Server, I think, is the only thing we can say so far.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we've got an interesting piece here in New York Times, an opinion piece from Jean Shaheen, who's a Democratic senator from New Hampshire. She's written an op-ed for the New York Times titled "The Russian Company That Is a Danger to Our Security." And in it, she says she wants to advance legislation to forbid U.S. government departments from running Kaspersky antivirus. She also says that she cannot repeat the classified intelligence that she has presumably been privy to. But this is interesting. And this piece has caught a lot of flack because, and I can see why, because it doesn't really reveal anything about what the allegations against Kaspersky are. But you would have to think that when you've got politicians who've seen the classified briefings actually proposing writing laws to lock you out of a market, you're going to have a bad time.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like it's, there is no hard evidence being pointed at in the open world. But yeah, like it's quite if you're going to waste your time sticking this particular stick in the ground, like you'd have to be pretty confident, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I know like the Australian government, for example, you know, versus having Huawei equipment in the network in Australia as being a thing that they didn't want. You know, we've seen this kind of thing before. It's not, you know, without precedent, but yeah, I mean, I guess we're just going to have to wait and see what, you know, in many years' time when we see what the, you know, the actual raw data leaks or something. But yeah, it's kind of hard to know what to make of it and like whether it will actually, you know, I mean, I guess it will get through. Like, I don't know.
Well, look, I mean, it's an issue that we've discussed before, which is, you know, everyone who works at Kaspersky in Russia, their families are in Russia, their lives are in Russia, and, you know, Putin and his pals tend to run that state as if they are the Soprano family. So, you know, you can understand the concerns there. I guess there's allegations that there's serious collusion between Kaspersky and the Russian intelligence services. And I have to say that I have caught some credible rumint to suggest that that is the case. But of course, it's very difficult to discuss that sort of stuff openly, right? But you'd think, you know, it would be nice to know a little bit more about the allegations. It would be nice to see a little bit more transparency here. But it is hard, right? Because how do you do that without exposing sources?
Well, exactly, yeah. And I guess for those of us in the private sector, right, who have to make decisions about software supply chain, you know, it is data that would be useful to have. I mean, the government doesn't operate in a vacuum. You know, it's dependent on external vendors that may well be running, you know, Kaspersky or other things that they are concerned about. But I guess, yeah, the big picture is this, you know, increasing concern, you know, about software supply chain and its interaction with national interests and the rise of a balkanized internet and software ecosystem where we, you know, just you don't have a global operating system or a global, you know, set of softwares or tools. I mean, you know, Microsoft being an American company, I'm sure puts the shit up Russia.
Well, I mean, the other thing too is that Kaspersky has developed an industrial control system operating system, in essence. And you would think before they can do their big US push to convince all of their utilities to use their wonderful new SCADA platform, that, yeah, that could go bad is what I'm saying, right? Like if someone did manage to exert substantial influence over a company that makes your industrial control system platform, that's a bad thing.
Yeah, like you could certainly see that going pretty wrong. And yeah, I guess you'd have to have a pretty compellingly high, you know, evidence, barrier of evidence to kind of prove that your stuff was any good. And I guess that's as good a segue as any into the next story.
Yes, China is doing some source code review. They've enacted a new law. They voted in the law in 2016, but it's come into effect in June this year. And basically any foreign company that wants to do business in China can be forced to hand over its source code to the Chinese government for review. The funny part, and I guess, you know, why we're talking about it, is they're handing it over to the same agency that, like, does a whole bunch of APT campaigns. So that, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, well, you know, okay, right.
But they're levering those synergies like, whoa.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it makes sense though, right? Because it's the SIGINT computer people who tend to do these types of reviews. I don't know how much to read into this, but it is a thing, right? You hand over your source code to another company's intelligence agency. They're probably going to check it for bugs. They're probably going to keep some and maybe tell you about some, right? That's just how it's going to go.
Well, it's what I would expect my government to do, right? If the New Zealand government got hold of, you know, source code to Windows, for example, which, you know, clearly they did as part of Five Eyes, I would expect them to go find some bugs and keep them on the shelf, right? I mean, they're not going to go blow them all and waste all that time they've spent, you know, inspecting the source for bugs. So yeah, like it's kind of hard to throw stones at the Chinese over this one, eh?
Yeah, it is. Russia again. Russia got kicked out of its consulate in San Francisco as part of these, measures taken by Obama against them over the election interference. What's interesting is they were burning something that looks like, I mean, that looks like PCB smoke to me. That looks like electronics smoke. So, you know, a bunch of people noticed that on the day that they were leaving, there was a bunch of really smelly, acrid smoke coming out of a chimney on the roof. The fire brigade turned up and we're told, yeah, no, it's okay. We're just burning some stuff in the fireplace. So that's like someone's HSM, right? Like just going up in smoke.
No, it is pretty funny. I guess you did do electrical engineering, right? So you're familiar with the burnt PCB smell.
Yes, yes. It's rather distinctive. So I'm sure sure someone out there would go, yes, I know that smell.
I can smell what model of HSM that is, a Kaspersky one perhaps.
But I do wonder what they were burning, don't you?
Whatever it was probably very expensive. I imagine, you know, Russian defense contractors overcharged just as much as everybody else's.
That's it. Oh, now turning our attention to this bloke, Francis Rawls, who's a former Philadelphia cop. He's been in prison for 2 years for refusing to decrypt a hard drive. And it looks like he's in there indefinitely. The way this story's gone is, cops had a warrant to inspect his hard drive because he was a suspect in a child abuse investigation. And he's just said, no way. And then he said, oh, I've forgotten my password and stuff like that. And they're saying, okay, well, you can just sit in prison and try to remember.
Yeah, so he's been in there a couple of years. He's appealed a couple of times, and the government has basically said, under the All Writs Act, we can hold you forever for not handing over your passphrase, you know, kind of tough. And that's where he is. Yeah, I mean, the backstory of this case doesn't look particularly good for him. Like, you know, there's witnesses who've seen him with child porn on said drives, and there's logs that have, like, the hashes of files he downloaded, which match known child porn. So, you know, kind of child pornographer. But, so he's just going to rot in jail until he remembers his passphrase. And, you know, it would suck to be the guy who did legitimately forget his passphrase and get thrown in jail forever, but...
Yeah. I don't know, man. I'd like to see this guy on a polygraph when it comes to talking about whether or not he can remember his password. What'll probably happen, man? They'll probably crack it eventually. Do you know what I mean? Like if there's a if there's an unlock technique that gets exposed. But then again, why would they do him any favors, right? It's just this weird situation where someone's basically sitting in prison indefinitely. It makes me feel uncomfortable, even though this guy's clearly a turd, you know?
Yeah, no, agreed. Like clearly it's a thing that you don't really want to happen on a regular basis. You know, people incarcerated forever with no process, but yeah.
Ah, here we go. Two stories from ThreatPost proving once and for all that AWS S3 buckets are the new, like a giant new anonymous FTP server because we got 4 million Time Warner cable records that were left on a misconfigured bucket. And we've also got a whole bunch of military contractor data, all just left around on S3 buckets, man. Two different firms found this data. It wasn't the same firm who found them.
Yeah, and there's been lots of people, I guess, in the last year or so, once it got a bit of prominence, going around and looking, you know, scanning for and discovering S3 buckets, you know, you can like DNS brute force and then check to see where the buckets exist and whether you've got read permissions on them. And yeah, people are finding all sorts of great stuff. In this case, yeah, there was data from a S3 bucket that belonged to a company, BroadSoft, with lots and lots of custom data for people from Time Warner Cable. The other one, the military, it was like a site that was doing handling like resumes for applying for jobs at some defense contractor, and their third party like recruiter had just left it lying around. And the really funny thing is that the people who found this, UpGuard, this particular one, got in contact with the defense contractor people, military contractor people, and sent them a mail saying, "Hey, we found a bunch of your data on a S3 bucket," and they assumed it was a fish. Ignored it.
Which I don't know whether to give them a pat on the back, because at least they're looking for phishing, right? Like that's
they were afraid it was ransomware, which is, dear. I mean, you know, and yeah, why not, right? It'd be a great lure. We found a whole bunch of your data. Click here to see what we got. You know?
Yeah. No, like, that's why I say I'm conflicted, because, you know, would you click that? I don't know. Oh, you sent me this story. Turns out MasterCard's internet gateway, man. MasterCard have been spending too much time smoking the hash, not enough time working on the hashing.
Indeed. Yeah. Someone
That was an awful pun. Awful pun. I promise I won't do it again for the rest of the show. Continue.
Someone found a bug in the MasterCard Internet Gateway servers, which is basically the thing that when you're doing payment, hand off to MasterCard, and it does the like 3D secure extra authentication step process thing, which is kind of a lot of form posting with extra variables that are, you know, passed by your browser between the various components, and the integrity of those, because they're going through your browser, not through some kind of back channel, is protected with some, you know, cryptography signatures and hashes and that kind of thing. Anyway, yeah, so it turns out that there was, I guess it's kind of a canonicalization bug where you could essentially alter the amount of money the transaction was for and have the signature not be invalidated through some, you know, actually relatively basic skullduggery. So very, very funny. They presumably are going to move to a slightly more robust mechanism at some point. The guy got $8,500, which I guess is, you know, it's better than nothing, but given how much you probably could have made with this particular bug in the wild, perhaps a little on the low side. But yeah, anyone who's in the in the pen testing business, web application security business, and you look at payment, this kind of payment flow stuff all the time, totally worth reading his write-up and making sure you do understand how to find and catch this particular sort of thing.
The MongoDB apocalypse is experiencing a second wave, shall we say, Adam?
Yeah, there's been a bunch of groups doing the rounds, breaking into people's MongoDBs, you know, breaking in, I guess I put in scare quotes in the sense that there's probably no auth on said MongoDBs, but anyway, logging in, you know, connecting to people's MongoDBs and ransoming the data. It's unclear whether this particular set of people actually, are keeping the data to give it back when you pay the ransom, or whether they're just kind of deleting it like the last crew was. But yeah, there's a bunch of people, like 20-something, 30-something thousand sets of MongoDBs have been owned in the last little while by this kind of thing. People are making some money out of it. Everyone's agile, you know, hipster future these days. And there's lots of people standing up new MongoDBs every day. And I guess the fool and his MongoDB are soon parted.
I mean, you host 45,000 of them. If 100 of them pay, you know, $1,000 each, that's $100,000, right? So incentives. Bleeping Computer reports about a bunch of vulns found in mobile bootloaders for major vendors. This is, mobile device bootloaders. This is interesting.
Yeah, so this is, A, interesting because of the bugs themselves, which are especially looking at ways you can influence the control flow of the various hardware-specific bootloaders for Android hardware, you know, by modifying, you know, contents of non-volatile RAM or something like that during startup. So it's interesting because of the bugs themselves. It's also interesting because of the process by which they identified them. So this was a group of computer scientists from University of California, Santa Barbara, and they built a testing framework which does sort of like taint analysis on the bootloaders so that they can map what inputs they take, whether they can be manipulated by an attacker, and then what kind of the way that those are processed. And then using this, they've identified something like six different flaws in different Android bootloaders across, you know, Huawei and NVIDIA and Qualcomm and all that kind of thing. So yeah, interesting set of bugs, but also an interesting approach, and good to see, you know, actual good quality research coming out of computer science people as well. So yay.
Oh, now here's another fun one from Bleeping Computer. There's a banking Trojan, a fairly established banking Trojan out there that's now targeting Coinbase users as well, which makes a lot of sense. Why bother trying to exfil cash to turn it into Bitcoin to turn it back into cash when you can just steal the Bitcoin?
Yeah, that seems very forward thinking. Yes. Now this is the TrickBot banking Trojan, which is one of the more kind of regularly updated ones. Anyway, they've added support for scraping Coinbase credentials during login and then stealing people's Bitcoins, which, as you say, yeah, it does seem like a much faster path than having to go through the whole, you know, tedious internet banking process. So yeah, I guess innovation there in the cybercrime world.
Now, we've got a couple of stories here discussing things that have happened in China. And I think in both cases, what I find really interesting when we report on you know, China technology issues stories is it's a real what-if scenario. You can look at what they do and say, well, gee, what would happen if they did, if a government did this? And China just does it, right? So they've just sent a guy to prison for 9 months for selling VPN software, right? So that's the first story. That's pretty grim.
Yeah, it's not like he even was particularly successful at it, eh? Like he made, what, like 14,000 yuan, like $2,000? So yeah, not exactly a criminal mastermind, but, you know, you want to send a message.
Yeah, the message being don't sell people tools that let them read the BBC website, because that's bad, according to China, right? So they really are, like the crackdown is real. And I just wonder when they're going to get serious about doing network-based monitoring for things like Meek transport, because as far as I know, Meek transport for Tor, which is like domain-fronted traffic, like that works okay. And the way China normally discovers things like Tor nodes is they actually just try to connect to them and get them to talk Tor, right? With domain fronting, it's a bit different. You can't just blacklist, you know, Google or Amazon domains, right? Because you're going to bring down a lot of other stuff. That's the idea. But I'm wondering when they're actually going to go for network controls that will enable them to snipe connections when they detect Meek. So I'm sure it's coming, right? But that's a much harder problem to crack at scale, you would think.
Yeah, especially compared to just throwing some dude in jail. Easy, right?
Yeah. Now, look, we're going to move on into our sort of topic of the week. And it's funny because I reached out to a bunch of people to sort of talk about this. And it was an interesting experience, right? Because I want to talk about initial coin offerings. Now, of course, an initial coin offering is when you swap your Bitcoin or your Ether or your cash, you know, you buy some Bitcoin or Ether, and then you want to buy some tokens that, unlike cryptocurrency, have been issued by an organization that might be a startup, right? So it's almost like a mini float, like on the stock market. The only difference is these tokens don't actually represent ownership of the company floating them, and they don't entitle you to any sort of reward because then they're treated like a security and the regulatory ban hammer comes down. But the reason I want to talk about this is Bitcoin has taken a hammering over the last few days because China has actually banned ICOs because they're saying, this is stupid, you've got to stop.
Yeah, no, there's been a bit of a pushback, eh? Like the ICO, I guess it's a bubble, right? I mean, people, there's been so much chatter about coin offerings and things around the place. And we've seen the US Securities and Exchange Commission step in, I think only what in the case of one so far, the actual Ethereum DAO people. But yeah, seeing China, which, you know, obviously pretty major economy, throw ICOs out of their, you know, out of their world, like that's a bit of a, you know, it's a very stern message, I guess. But they really have just been, seems to be picking up steam. There's a graph somewhere that shows a sort of exponential growth in the number of ICOs. And of course, the process of actually, you know, technically carrying out an ICO on top of, say, the Ethereum blockchain is really not that complicated. I mean, people have been putting up joke coin ICOs that, are making real money.
Dude, even. Useless coin raised 40 grand. Okay. I mean, that's the thing, right? Now, look, I did speak to Asher Tan, who's the CEO of CoinJar, this morning about this idea that the tokens don't actually represent anything. And they don't, right? Like, as I mentioned, as I alluded to at the top of the show, they're sort of like itchy and scratchy dollars. You remember when Homer goes to Itchy and Scratchy World and buys his itchy and scratchy dollars, and then he walks in and there's just signs everywhere saying itchy and scratchy dollars not allowed. So people are buying these things with the expectation that they're going to carry some sort of value, but there is nothing underpinning that value. Like even with Bitcoin, you've got energy costs and GPU mining costs associated with that. But here's what Asher Tan, CEO of CoinJar, told me this morning.
There's some instances where the token makes sense in the context of the application. So, for instance, you're buying a token in a sports betting company, right? And if they say that the token will be the unit of account for the sports bet, sort of makes sense. You say the token is used to do a special contract, or, you know, it's a verifying token, then you might say, like, these tokens have value. I think there's one token out there called Basic Attention Token, and it's sort of like an ad token. So you could, like, sort of pay for ads or pay for ads to go away. So in those contexts, that the token has some sort of intrinsic value, but not in all cases. And then there are cases where people are pre-selling not the token itself, but it's like a pre-sale to get the token. So that's like a derivative of a derivative, if you will. Yeah, it is very speculative. But again, we've had these same arguments that Facebook is a bubble to the same degree when they were doing the IPO. Some of these coins don't really serve any purpose and may be over-promising in the promotional material. And the regulator is always there to protect consumers. And if they think that there needs to be some protection, they'll definitely do it. I don't see why not. The whole pretense of Silicon Valley is you get more funding, people run around, tinker with new technologies, something beautiful comes out of it. So if there are 100 projects, even if you would tell me 80% of them are rubbish, can someone create something very useful and great out of this new technology? I would not want to be the person betting against it.
Now, Adam, we've seen $1.8 billion US dollars go into ICOs just this year, and these are for non-mined coins that are traded on exchanges, okay? So, I mean, that's just a staggering amount of money to me. That's a lot of investment activity for something which is essentially itchy and scratchy dollars.
Yeah, exactly. That is very, very real money. And clearly there's going to be some people who are making, you know, very real money out of it. But there's going to be a lot of people who, you know, are gambling and are going to lose. I mean, that's just the way that this has to work. Because as you said, there really isn't, in most of these cases, any intrinsic value. And I mean, the only, you know, if you're a startup that's minting coins to, you know, to kind of raise money, the only way that you can then go do anything with them is to cash out, right? And to remove the value that, you know, of the coins that you've just sold to people and go
you're missing something very important, which is that these tokens that you buy in an ICO don't actually represent a share of value in the company. They are not a security. They're not tied to anything, right? So it might just be a currency that you use on your platform. That's why I use the itchy and scratchy dollars thing, because that's exactly what these things are. They are itchy and scratchy dollars for new businesses that are being created off the back of funding via Bitcoin. Now, if these were more like micro IPOs, where you were actually buying a slice of whatever it is that you're tipping money into, I could see this as being a really handy way to raise money. The problem, of course, is that that's when the regulations get quite restrictive, and that's where the costs come from. Like paying a stock market operator to handle your shares and the trading of your shares on a stock market, that's not actually the expensive part. The expensive part is compliance, right? Now, that's not to say people aren't making money from this, because of course, when you have something like, you know, of that $1.8 billion worth of Ether and Bitcoin that have gone into these things, a lot of that is new money coming into the Bitcoin ecosystem, which these days, depending on what time it is, has a market capitalization of something like, you know, a total value of Bitcoin is something between $70 and $80 billion. Now, there's a lot of talk that there's about bid-ask fraud in the Bitcoin ecosystem. There's a group of traders out there controlling an absolutely huge pile of Bitcoins, and they're putting in dodgy bids and asks and not actually executing trades. And because the regulation is much more lax, there's no one coming down on them for that. So there is price manipulation going on there. So you've got someone manipulating the price, holding up the value, pulling people into the ICO hype, right? And, you know, you've got to think at some point when ICOs go pop, there's going to be a bit of a rush for the exits for ICO tokens, and they're going to be essentially, you know, a lot of them will be worth nothing. Some of them might be worth something. You heard what Asher said, and I agree with him. Who knows? There might be something of value created out of this. But my concern is that when the ICO bubble pops, we're going to see a lot of people just sort of giving up on Bitcoin, and we're certainly going to see the inflows drying up, and that will result in price falls, you would think.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of speculation is, you know, in the end, I don't think good for the cryptocurrency ecosystem as a whole. And regardless of the difference between, you know, the more established players, Ethereum, Bitcoin, and, you know, Burger King, Whopper Coin, or whatever else, you know, regardless of that, people do see them as one kind of thing. And the fallout for both the value and the sort of the perceived confidence in something like, I mean, to the extent you can have any confidence in Bitcoin, the perceived confidence in the kind of cryptocurrency blockchain-backed infrastructure thing. Although, mind you, there's just so much going on in the blockchain space, and like there must be something good that will eventually fall out of it, because we do, you know, we do see so many people pinning so many hopes on this kind of distributed verifiable architecture. I mean, even, you know, something like the certificate, the way the certificate transparency logs are stored, like it's almost kind of blockchain-y in a way. You know, producing a, you know, sort of read-only, append-only log is kind of cool. But yeah, it's just a lot of people are going to get a lot of burnt, you know, and
yeah,
a lot of people who are dodgy are going to make serious cash and then go reinvest it, you know, into other, you know, criminal or, you know, scammy enterprises. But, you know, hey, I guess this is just what, you know, free market looks like. You know, this is why we developed all this regulation and very expensive, you know, compliance cost around investment and, yeah, and all of the sort of, you know, weird derivative money products, because anyone who can jump through a loophole somewhere is gonna. You know, we've seen the fallout in the real financial markets.
I want to make it clear too that I'm not shitting on Bitcoin, right? Like Bitcoin has proved its worth and the technology is good. It's just that people are applying this. You know, a lot of people investing in these ICOs seem to think that they're something that they're not, which is a way of buying ownership of something. It doesn't. In fact, a lot of the terms and conditions for ICOs actually state that the purchase of a token via their ICO is a donation.
Yeah, that's the key word there. You're going to give your money to somebody else and then they're going to take it and go do something.
All right, mate. Well, that's actually it for the week's news and for the week's discussion. Thank you very much for having that with me. It's a pleasure to chat to you, and we'll catch you again next week.
Yeah, certainly will, pal. I'll look forward to it.
That was Adam Boileau of Insomnia Security there with a look at the week's security news and a discussion of the ICO phenomenon. Let's see where that one goes. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Faru Mavituna of NetSparker. NetSparker makes an automated web application security scanning tool. These types of tools aren't a substitute for specialized manual in-depth testing, but oftentimes they will be used by pen testers to speed up tests and make their workflow a little bit more manageable. But there's also another very compelling use case for automated testing tools, which is scale. Now, in preparation for this chat, NetSparker sent over a YouTube video of Faru speaking at InfoSecurity Europe. It's basically a 20-minute pitch for doing automated testing at scale, and it threw some numbers at me that were pretty mind-boggling. NetSparker actually has customers with 1,000 web apps across the organization. Now, of course, in a perfect world, you'd have a team of crack pen testers go out and have a look at all of them, but that is just not feasible, as anyone responsible for wrangling that many apps would know. But with an automated approach, you can at least start with the worst stuff. And as Faru will explain, there's plenty of dumb stuff to go around. So yeah, starting with the high impact, trivially discoverable stuff seems like good advice. But before we got into that, I asked him how on God's green earth a company winds up with 1,000 web applications. Here's what he said.
Initially, I was quite surprised as well. You know, when I talk with a customer and they tell me they have about 1,000 web applications, I'm like, okay, why do you want to ask?
Yeah, what are you doing? Reevaluate your life choices.
So it kind of didn't register. But it's actually, there are a couple of aspects of this, right? So what is an application? I think that's the first, what's a web application? That's the first thing we need to kind of discuss about. So normally what we look at generally, like, you know, you got google.com and it's your web application done. But in reality, it's a little bit more than that, right? Even in the simplest, even in a very simple web application, what you end up with, the web application itself from on the production stage, right? And then you have possibly some sort of admin management, right? And then now you got two applications. And then you will have staging environment and maybe two copies in the staging environment, quite common. So you have four applications. Even though it's one application, one side application, now you have four. If you use anything like microservices, web services, you got a bunch of other small web services, right?
Yeah.
And
no, I'm with you. I mean, I run a static site, but I've still got something that generates the content for the site, right? So I like to say that there's no web application, but there is.
There is, exactly. And even on top of that, then as a corporation, you have a bunch of internal web applications to some of them are just third parties, right? But some of them are internally custom built stuff like for billing, for HR purposes, for other purposes. And now if you also, if you have a really big corporation, right, it's quite common to acquire other companies. So when you acquire a company with internal applications, their web application, their side applications, their staging environments, you acquire like 50 websites.
Yeah, and all of the associated things that keep those 50 websites running. Okay, so I can see how you get to the 1,000 figure, right, without too much trouble.
Right, and to be fair with you, just recently we had a new customer and I never even heard about them before, right? It's apparently a very big customer providing some backend services to a particular vertical, and they actually have 5,000 applications.
Yeesh.
Which is mind-blowing. And when we see these, right?
So you did this talk, right, at InfoSec Europe, and it was interesting because you were talking about this until we've just spoken, this mythical, what I thought was a mythical creature who was someone who had the misfortune of being responsible for that many web apps. But these people do exist. And you were talking about how you scale up and try to do some testing. And you were talking about what's good about automation and where automation falls down. It's interesting, though, because you were coming up with some stuff that I really, you know, just absolutely wouldn't have thought of, which is, well, first of all, you know, you can catch stuff early when you automate. So that's cheaper, it's easier, that's just generally better. So that's one definite plus in the automation column. Look, another thing you mentioned was, you know, automating discovery is pretty important because you got to know what's there so that you can test it. But that's not always straightforward, is it?
It's actually a very complex problem. It's extremely common, even from penetration testing point of view. You know, when I was a pen tester, we used to go to companies and they told us like, okay, here is our website, but possibly there are more we don't know of. And so here is our IP that you go ahead and figure out.
Yeah, well now, I mean, it's gone beyond that, right? Because now that everyone's hosting stuff in Amazon, that's not in their IP range. And your best hope of finding it is hoping that you can pick it out of SSL transparency logs or something.
Exactly that. So I think that's why with the increase of cloud usage, that's why we also in parallel seen a very open source intelligence gained a lot of popularity as well. And, you know, like stuff like you mentioned, watching SSL transparency logs, or there are a bunch of projects like scanning the whole internet and putting all that data in somewhere so we can like look through this sonar data, right? So many of them.
Yeah, and you just hope someone's been silly enough to put the company name in the header, right? Like, or in a banner somewhere.
Right, but I mean, to be honest, SSL, possibly the best indicator today to do any kind of correlation in that kind of data. But in addition to that, there are just so many leaks on web applications, to be honest. I mean, there are two aspects of it. So from an organization point of view, what you want to do, you want to find all of your inventory. And there are like various ways to do it. You can start from internal and external. But there's another aspect of it where one of your employees puts up an application online, puts in a hidden domain or some random IP address that, you know, he thinks no one would ever know about, like security through obscurity kind of practice. And then what we are missing is all the modern applications are leaking crazy amount of data. Beside of SSL transparency logs kind of third party, you know, leaking data, let's say that that's also another kind of leak. You got also other leaks like referrers, all the third party JavaScript widgets and all that sort of stuff. So imagine you have an internal application a public application, internet facing, but a private domain or completely random IP address that not linked from anywhere else. And then you got a chat application in there. Someone puts a URL. You click that, bam, you leaked your referral. So now someone knows you got an application in there.
Yeah, well, and a lot of the toolbars from browsers used to knock out like private URLs as well, right? You'd set up some really obscure domain and then hit it with Google Chrome and then Google knows about it.
Exactly that. And there are just so many leaks. And today it's pretty much, I mean, you have to accept once something is online, if it's barely an application with some, you know, some features, you got to assume that someone knows about it.
Yeah, but how are you? Are you actually doing much with the OSINT piece, NetSpark? I mean, because you do, you know, web application security vulnerability scanning, but are you doing much with discovery or are you just leaving that to the clients?
We're leaving that to the clients. I mean, if necessary, we guide them. But it's not something we focus. We believe in doing what we know best, what we do best. And if there's a solution out there to solve that problem, we will lead you to that solution instead of trying to kind of reinvent that wheel.
Now, of course, you weren't just speaking about what automation's good for. You were talking about what automation isn't really good for. And I mean, the things that you highlighted were things that we kind of spoke about last time you were on the show. Things like, you know, logic, web app logic issues like bad password recovery processes, you know, really design specific and non-generic issues that might affect some sort of exotic application on an unusual platform and stuff like that. And also discovering all of the flows and the processes in websites. But say someone were to commit to, you know, using a tool like NetSparker to try to wrangle 1,000 web apps, because that's just the number that's, you know, most useful to talk about because it's a nice big number. Like, what do you recommend they actually do in terms of like using the tool to do that? Where are their efforts best directed? Are they looking for the more generic SQLIs and cross-site scripting bugs? Or do you suggest sort of much more fine-tuned scans that are better tailored towards one organization's approach to web apps?
Right. In terms of how to use the tool, in what we do in NetSpark, you got options. Obviously, you can go ahead and configure every single website. And what it will give you faster scans because, for example, you will explicitly say the scan, okay, don't look for it because it's not relevant to this website. But the problem with that, it can take time. So it depends what you are trying to accomplish and what kind of resources you have. If you have 20 people and if you have 1,000 websites that you constantly scanning like every other month or something like that, then it might worth spending quite a bit of time to configuring them individually and getting them all right for once. However, there is another possibility which you can just dump 1,000 applications and just start scanning. And that will still give you almost like excluding authenticated applications, right? That's something else. Excluding authenticated applications, you will get a lot of benefit. And because of cloud capabilities, the time won't change because normally we configure and optimize scans to make the scans faster. But when you have 1,000 applications, it doesn't matter whether one application, you know, scanning an application is slow or not, as long as they are all scanned at the very same time. So you can still have 1,000 applications. At the end of the day, it will only take 24 hours to scan 1,000 applications. So you don't really need to configure much. And what we do with NetSparker is we got this kind of motto, right? We say, if someone can be automated, it has to be automated. To give you a very good example, we configure as users, we configure scanners, so they can be accurate. To a very common example, if you have a URL rewrite on your web application, and if you don't configure it while scanning, what happens is web application scanner will not able to pick up what is a parameter and what is a value. In addition to the fact that crawling will take ages because it will look like a massive dynamic website, in addition to that, you will have another problem, which is you will not find vulnerabilities in the URL rewrite section of the website, which is quite crucial. So in NetSpark, we noticed this problem and we are like, okay, one solution, we can let user to configure it, which would work. But a better solution would be, can we figure out heuristically what URL rewrite rules are? So the way we designed that feature is, when NetSpark scans a website, if there's a URL rewrite, it will automatically pick it up. It will see, okay, I see this pattern, just like an actual human being, just like a penetration tester would visit a website and say, oh, clearly there is a URL rewrite in here, and here is the pattern, here is the parameter name, here is the value of, you know, whatever. And NetSpark does the same thing. And then as a pen tester, as a user, you can say, okay, I'm going to overwrite these settings if you like.
Yeah.
So my point in on 1,000 applications, you can just put them in and NetSpark will do its best to configure them correctly out of the box anyway.
Yeah, that, I guess, though, from what you were saying in your talk, like, it's not like you're not going to have issues to follow up on if you throw this at 1,000 web apps, right? You're going to have plenty to do before you have to worry about the exotic stuff.
That's arguably the bigger problem, right? So one thing I keep telling when we talk with a customer and they are telling me, okay, we have 1,000 applications. My first question is, what are you doing today? And what they told me is quite funny. And I keep hearing the same problem, same answer. They either say, don't even ask, right? It's horrible. I don't want to even explain that. Or they simply say, look, we got about 50 really important applications, kind of mission critical. We get them pen tested. And remaining 950, we don't really do much. They are just there. And, you know, they get hacked up and then we get notification. Then we go ahead and replace the website.
Yeah, well, I guess, in that scenario, automation is going to be your only option.
Right. So what I tell them, look, what I'm going to tell you is kind of life-changing for you. Because in 24 hours, I'm going to tell you lots of vulnerabilities about 1,000 of your websites. And in addition to that, I'm going to tell you which one of them are real and got real-world risk associated. So I'm not going to tell you just this website might be vulnerable. The NetSpark is going to tell you this website is vulnerable to SQL injection, and I've got proof. Here is your, name of your database from your website.
That's it. And then you can come back in 4 weeks and see if it's fixed or not. So that's nice, right? Especially, doing that at scale, it is the only way you can do that.
That's it. Because otherwise, what you're going to end up with, let's say 10 issues average per website, and generally it's small, to be honest, then you got 10,000 issues. And imagine how many people who understand security need to review 10,000 issues to figure out which one of them are real, which one of them got real risk, and then prioritize and then start fixing. So there's like massive amount of resources you need to go through to get that stage, to the stage of this is real and we need to fix it.
Yeah. All right. Look, Faru Mavituna, thanks a lot for joining us on the show. And thanks again for sponsoring an episode of Risky Business.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. Thank you.
That was Faru Mavituna there. He is the CEO of NetSparker. You can find them at netsparker.com. And yeah, if you want to do some web app testing at scale, go check them out. Big thanks to NetSparker for sponsoring this week's edition of the show. And they, like many other sponsors, have signed on to be sponsors in 2018 as well. So everything's looking totally peachy. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Thank you.